still fine.
Yeah, he's. I took it. I sat in on it like 3 years ago, and I thought it was just great. So, any of you who need a distribution requirement, that's a good one. He's not a totally easy grader, but for a science professor, he's a pretty easy grader. And if you memorize the last paragraph of Origin of Species, did he tell you that?
He didn't tell us about that part yet.
Okay, so.
I haven't started reading that yet.
Yeah. Well, one thing, you can get extra credit on the final by typing it out correctly or writing it out correctly, complete with punctuation marks, though. You have to get the punctuation marks right as well.
How long is it?
It's like 8 lines.
Okay.
Easy to subvocalize.
Mm-hmm. That's perfect, because I'm taking that class as my science. So.
All right.
Yeah.
So go for it. This is the evolution class, yeah.
Yeah, that's actually the 16, I think. 16,
yeah.
Yeah. All right, so yeah, last paragraph. It's there is grandeur in this view of life is how it begins.
Perfect.
Okay. At some point, I think he actually quotes some poetry. I talked to him about it. And I think he actually is going to quote some poetry at some point. Darwin and Abraham Lincoln were born the same day. So there's your interesting fact of the day. Okay, let's go back to the handout, which I hope you have. And now... I think she'll just get the recording. So what?
I was not here last
time. Oh, I'm sorry. And did you not get the email?
Should I just open my laptop for it?
I guess so. Really, you shouldn't be using electronic devices, only me. But it's okay for today. That's okay. No, I get it. Beginning of the semester. So we were talking about, was there anyone else not here on Friday? Okay, so we were talking about the James Murrell poem Body, which we looked at briefly, and we could spend the whole class on it, but we won't. But take a look at it again. And one of the questions that's always going to come up when reading poetry is, when do you go from something that's really there to English professor overreading? So I'm sure that ever since like middle school, you've been aware of how English teachers tend to find more there than is really there, right? Yeah, even with a mask, I can see a slightly guilty, slightly superior look. So that is a question that is a legitimate one. Let me just say that for the purposes of this class, what we are going to try to do is think about a poem for at least a fraction of the time that the writer of the poem thought about it. That is that what often happens when you overread is that what you're kind of thinking is, you know, this is a great poem. I read it. I really liked it. Turn the page. But the poet might have spent like 12 hours, like 2 hours a line writing a poem. I think you might be able to believe that about Body. And part of the question is, so what thought went into it that we can try to recover? Why was it worth it to the poet to spend that much time looking at it? But there's also, it's always a legitimate question, are we overreading or not? And I think that we'll definitely overread some poems in this class, but it's gonna be much more the case that we won't get to the bottom of the poems that we're looking at, that we'll get in, we'll be in the right direction to get there. At least I hope so. We'll maybe see where to go to see more. But the question, do we ever get to the bottom of a poem? In a way, the answer is no, because you'd have to be the poet themselves to get to the very bottom. That is, there are always going to be private things that words mean to the poet, places, to quote the great 18th century critic Edmund Burke, who none of you, I think, are history majors, but Edmund Burke is known in history as kind of the prince of conservatives, that is, not of reactionaries, like people who call themselves conservatives now but are not. but people who basically, whose basic idea is go slow. But he's also famous in literature for having written, when he was a young man in his late 20s, a book called A Philosophical Enquiry into the Sublime and Beautiful. So before he was being a member of parliament and doing politics, he was thinking about literature. And in that book, he has a beautiful section where he talks about how words sometimes affect us, especially words that we learned before we learned the concepts that they stood for, like virtue. His example is actually wise, virtuous, discreet, good, great. And he says that originally we learned to evaluate these words positively because, as he puts it, they were originally heated by the breath of others. So what happens is, and I'm sure everyone can think of this, there's some adult, a parent, a grandparent, an elder sibling, a cousin, an uncle, an aunt, someone of that sort, when you were very young, who you learned a word from, or you kind of have a sense of how they said that word. And that becomes part of the private resonance of that word for you. It's something, if you sort of engage in I remember type meditations, where you're just recollecting as intensely as you can, early memories, early experiences, good ones, not traumatic ones. Some of those experiences will just be the tone with which someone you loved said a word that at the time you didn't know. And that's just going to be part of its emotional coloration, that word's emotional coloration for you, all your life. And poets probably have that experience at an above average level. So one of the ways we can't get to the bottom of a poem is that we can't quite ever get to the resonance of some of those important words for them, words that have a kind of life meaning for them. And so that's one reason you can never get to the bottom of a poem. It's not that poems are too complex, although some are, to see everything. It's that they have resonances for the poet that we will partly share and partly not. And to the extent that we share it, that's really cool. Sometimes they'll have resonances for us that they won't have for the poet, which is, again, why people sometimes overread. But there is both sharing and a limit to sharing when you read poetry. Poetry is about sharing, but it's also about and trying to overcome those limits, but it's also, in a sense, never overcoming them entirely. So one reason that I picked body to start with is that I think that, and you can be honest about this. Actually, I learned a little trick from Dan Perlman, which is that this is really a trick about who's done the reading, where I can, you can't do it on Zoom, but I can turn my back and ask you to cough if you haven't done the reading. Now, there wasn't much reading for today, so it's not an issue. But what I'm going to do is I'll just hide my eyes like this and ask, just cough if you think we did any overreading of body on Friday. Okay, that's great. So the question is, how far into body would we have to get to start overreading? And so let's get a little further into it. So just to recall, so here's the poem. I'm sorry, remind me of your name. Yeah, because you're new. What is it?
Judy.
Judy. Okay. So this is your first experience of the poem, I think. So look closely at the letters. Can you see entering stage right, then floating full, then heading off? So soon, how like a little coal-rimmed moon, O plots her course from B to D, as Y, unanswered, knocks at the stage door. Looked at too long, words fail, phase out. Ask, now that body shines no longer, by what light you learned these lines and what the B and D stood for. So what we saw was that the letter O seems to be part of the letter B as it enters that line, stage right, as though the line of the poem is the stage, at least, let's say, the stage of Act 1, Scene 1. And then the O liberates itself from the B, is halfway across to the D, and then it disappears to the right, disappearing into the D. So it's a pure picture. And the Y is to the right of all of that, or stage left of all of that from the stage's point of view. And the pun is in the word Y. So the question is, why does O plot her course from B to D? A question that's unanswered. So no one answers the door for Y when Y knocks, because Y looks like a letter knocking at the door of the upright in D. But no one answers the question why. So not the door for Y, but the question itself, W-H-Y. Notice that it takes a little sub-vocalizing to see that overlap, that joke. That Y unanswered, if you're doing it purely visually, you would get that Y is like a hieroglyph or an ideogram knocking at the stage door, but that there's no answer to that knock, but you wouldn't get the pun on the question why, W-H-Y. And then, yeah, looked at too long, words fail, phase out. So we notice the moon imagery from the O looking like a little cull-rimmed moon to the idea that things phase out, like the phases of the moon, from a new moon to a full moon back to a new moon every 28 and a fragment days. Ask now that body shines no longer, because the word itself, it's like, to quote the great poet A.R. Ammons, as a word too much repeated. This is a poem called So I Said I Am Ezra, who was a childhood friend of his who died young. Has anyone heard of Ammons, A.R. Ammons? So the poem, he's great. The poem goes, I don't know if I can recite all of it, but it's, So I said I am Ezra, and the wind whipped my throat, gaming for the sounds of my voice. I am Ezra, I said. Yeah, then I forget what comes after that. But then the end of the poem is, as a word too much repeated falls out of being, so I, Ezra, went out into the night. That's not quite the end, but those are the lines that I wanted to focus you on. As a word too much repeated falls out of being, so I, Ezra, went out into the night. So that's what Merrill is saying here as well. Looked at too long, words fail, phase out. So do we all agree that part of what he's doing here is describing his experience writing the poem?
Maybe.
So he's looking closely at the letters, right? And he's got this great idea of the O, like a cull-rimmed moon, as though it's an actor playing the moon, is plotting a course from B to D. Y is unanswered. He's turned it into an ideogram. And then the picture somehow, he's just been looking at it too long. And then he starts reflecting on what happens when you look at that very picture too long, when you try this clever idea of what the words can look like, what they can stand for, what the letters can look like, what they can stand for. And then the very fact that that happens becomes part of what the poem is about. So instead of just what the letters look like, it's what happens when they stop looking like that because you've been looking too closely. When that really cool thing that you saw starts looking a little arbitrary. not really like what he had this great idea about. But then it's like he has a meta great idea, which is, yeah, what's happening to the word is what happened to the letter O. So we didn't talk about this last week, but do most of you think that that's what the meta great idea that he's having is here? Does that sound right? You sounded iffy about it.
A little bit, but I can see where you're coming from now, and I understand it a bit better.
Okay, good answer. So it's words do that, and now he's saying body shines no longer. So the word isn't shining the way it did when he first had that idea. It's like he typed out body, or he thought about the word, and it shone. And then he's still thinking about it, and it's not as cool as it seemed at first. But so words fade out. Ask now that body shines no longer. But remember, he is frail. He's about to die. He is of HIV, so he's in really delicate shape. And thinking maybe of the human body no longer shining, not only the word, but the human body itself, his body. So the word shines no longer. So by what light do you learn these lines? What kind of metaphor is that? What do you learn lines for?
A play.
So we're back to the theatrical metaphor, the stage door, the stage right, O going from the B to D. So if it's not through your body, what light do you learn these lines by? Where learning these lines might be something like reading these lines, having a class on these lines, learning how to write these lines if you're a poet, but you're a poet in very bad physical shape. And we all agreed on this, and what the B and D stood for, that the B and D stood for?
Birth and death.
Yeah. That the question is, so if body doesn't shine, why have a human life to begin with? Why be born? Why die? What did the B and D stand for if it's all meaningless? So here's an interesting, so this is a comparison I sometimes make. None of you is a math major, so it may not help this much, but there's a cool thing in math called Goldbach's conjecture. Anyone know what it is? So, and you're taking an English class? Goldbach's conjecture is actually way cool. Goldbach's conjecture, it's a 17th century conjecture, still hasn't been proved true or false, is, everyone know what a prime number is? Mm-hmm. Someone give me a prime?
Seven.
All right, I knew it was going to be seven. So Goldbach's conjecture is that every even number can be written as the sum of two primes. So how would you write 10 as the sum of two primes?
7 plus 3.
Good, yeah, you could also do 5 and 5. Sometimes it can be more. 20, 17 plus 3, 193 is 93 plus 7, and so on. So Goldbach thought, okay, I bet every even number can be written as a sum of two primes. For 300 years, people have been trying to prove or disprove it, and they haven't succeeded. There's been some work that's been made on it, but they haven't succeeded. I think the closest anyone has is that for sufficiently large numbers, you can prove that a sufficiently large number, but how large can be huge, huge. They can be written as the sum of at most four primes. So it might just be that Goldbach's conjecture is true. This is a possibility, that Goldbach's conjecture is true, but that there is no proof of it, that it can't be proved. That would be really weird, because it would be true by accident. That is, something that's true, but it's only accidentally true. And there are a lot of things in math that are like this. For example, you might think all odd numbers are prime, because 3 is a prime, and 5 is a prime, and 7 is a prime. So, oh, look, it looks like odd numbers are primes. But if you went to one more odd number, you get to 9, which is not a prime. So it's just accidental that some odd numbers are prime and some aren't. It's not the case that there's a general thing you can say about odd numbers that connect them to being prime, or about prime numbers that connect them to being odd. There are things you can say, obviously, but it's accidental if you take an odd number at random. 143. It would be accidental if it were prime or if it were composite, simply by virtue of being odd. But with Goldbach's conjecture, it's like somehow every even number might accidentally be the sum of two primes. And there are an infinite number of even numbers, so how can that happen? So that would be eerie. That would be weird if it were true. It would really be weird. And it's as though there was some cosmic accident, something in the universe, call it God, just did this thing. So an even number made it the sum of two primes. So another even number made it the sum of two primes. Did an infinite number of times. No reason, just a kind of game, a taste that God has, is that even number should be the sum of two primes. So accidents like that can be eerie. A little bit like the accidents of rhymes, that tomb should rhyme with womb, that sperm should rhyme with worm, that breath should rhyme with death. Now, there are only 3 of those, but imagine that every word in English rhymed with its antonym. That would start looking weird. If it weren't planned out in advance, it would start looking weird. That, that class would rhyme with cutting class, that school would rhyme, or that work would rhyme with unemployment, that Republican would rhyme with Democrat, that Trump would rhyme with Biden. Okay, so the odds against things rhyming with their opposite, so we find 3 decent examples, and there are a lot of decent examples, but they're interesting examples because it's so rare. Not vanishingly rare, but rare enough that it's cool when it happens. Like if cool rhymed with hot or with warm, but it doesn't. So it happens occasionally, and it's interesting because it happens. So what Merrill has done is found a word that somehow the letters are amazingly good for describing his condition and maybe the human condition. That it's the word body, and then the more you look at it, the more it's almost as though God, who made every even number the sum of two primes, decided that the word body in English was going to be a really good picture of human life. Yeah.
I kind of forget what I'm going to say now, but is it, when we're talking about like this thing that made it be this way, was it always this way? Or was it only when someone discovered it that it became this way?
Yeah, that's a great question. So it's as though, do people know about, now I forget what it's called, but Scholar's Rocks? So there's a Japanese art form that hit its peak in the 12th century, which is finding rocks. That's the form, is that you find rocks. You just take a hike on a mountain and you find rocks, stones, you know, this big.
I'm really good at that.
Yeah, so are my sandals. And however, and this is a cool thing, this is an art where what people would do is they would find these rocks, and there were masters, like Go masters and Zen masters and martial arts masters. There were rock finding masters. And they would find these amazing rocks in the middle of a landscape that no one else had seen. You know, they walked right past them, just a rock on the ground. And they would see it and pick it up and bring it home or bring it to a temple. And they would put it on, they would put it down on one side. And people would come and they'd be in awe of how amazing these rocks were. And the cool thing is that in Japanese culture, there is a complaint that there are no, that the high point of this art was the 12th century, and that there have been no artists since then who have been remotely as good as the 12th century artists at finding these rocks. So what's happening is you're finding something, but also you have to have a talent for seeing, a talent for finding that is actually really rare and takes a whole lot of cultivation. And in a sense, it's where finding and making and creating almost overlap. It's that you can see so well that seeing creates what's seen. So in poetry, this is sometimes called perceptual force. And it's something we'll talk about when we talk about meter. Perceptual force. That is that you perceive in a way that is creative, not because you're making something look like something it isn't, but because you're seeing something that no one has seen. But when you see it, you can share what you've seen with others, and now they'll see it too. So that's kind of what Merrill is doing with body here. Yes, no one else has seen this. He's the one seeing it. It wouldn't occur to anyone else. But he sees it so well that we see it too. We see the B and the D as the wings of the stage, and we see that B and D stand for birth and death. And it feels like he's seen something that's so amazingly well put together that someone must have put it together, like God. Now, of course, that's not true, but that's what's eerie about it, is how well the word body works. So here's this guy who's dying, who's looking at these words really, at these letters really carefully, and who is seeing the word become radiant, like the moon, but then also fail and phase out, like his own body, his own life. And the question is, why? And he's already told you why is unanswered. What did the B and D stand for? What for did they stand? What for do you stand, B and D? Why were they there? What was the reason? For what reason were they there? If that's all it's going to be. Okay, so I think on the whole, we agree with the details. Maybe it's too fast to go meta the way I did, but we agree on the details of the poem. Okay, there are further details, though. One of them, are you struck by how many O's there are in this poem? So look closely at the letters. Can you see entering stage right, then floating full, then heading off, so, soon, how? Notice four words in a row with O in them. Like a little coal-rimmed moon, O plots her course from B to D. So anyone want to take a guess how many O's in the first stanza? I should tell you, this is a student who discovered this, not me, so don't think I'm overreading it. It's one of you.
16.
Oh, huh. I think it's 18, but I could be wrong.
Let me double count.
I got 17. But I might have missed one.
Okay, so look is two, closely is three, you is four, floating is five. Right? Off is six. So soon is 7, 8, 9. Mm-hmm. How 10, coal 11.
Oh, yeah, 17.
Moon 12, 13. O 14. Plots 15. Oh. Course 16. No, from 17, two is 18.
Mm-hmm. I miss plots too.
Yeah, see, that's because you're hearing it and not seeing it. Okay, good. You know, the best Scrabble players, I don't know if this is still true, but the people who would always win the Scrabble tournaments in the U.S. Tended to be Thai people who knew no English, but they'd memorized the Scrabble dictionary, so they knew every word, and meanings weren't interfering with their purely visual sense of words. So here you could look, if you spoke no English, it would be easier to count the 18 O's. Okay, how many in the second stanza? Okay, so what do we think of that? Coincidence?
Probably not. Now I don't know anymore.
I think it's a bit of a stretch. Like, I don't know. Like, not to say, like, it's not how, like, poets work, but did he really sit down here and was like, I'm going to make it be 18 yeah. O's per stanza?
Is there any significance to that number?
Okay.
Is that just another random coincidence?
What purpose would you have for doing that?
All right, is there any significance of the number 18? Anyone know?
Judaism.
Yeah, what is it?
It's chai.
Which means?
Like luck.
No, it means life.
Oh.
Like l'chaim.
Yeah.
Yeah, so if you have a bar mitzvah or bat mitzvah, or if you go to one,
money.
The money is in multiples of 18.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Because 18 means life. Because of the way Hebrew letters work is that each letter is also a numeral, and so the two letters that make up the Hebrew word for life will sum up to 18. So 18 is actually a lucky number for in Jewish culture. So here are two 18s. If it were two 16s, it might seem maybe slightly more coincidental. I don't know. Uh-huh.
And then, like, what I've heard, anyways, is that the meaning of that, at least from the author, is that, like, 42, when you say the words for each letter in Japanese, that's also the Japanese word for, like, death.
Oh, whoa. Okay, I thought it was just fortitude. But, yeah, no, that's really cool.
That's what I've heard.
Yeah, no, that's great. Makes sense? Yeah.
If we are going against it being a coincidence, I will say that there are a lot of double, like, lettered O's, which if you're trying to get to 18, you want to cram as many in there as you can. So
uh-huh.
There's a lot of those words, which, you know, would point to the author, you know, trying to put a lot of O's into the stanzas.
Yeah. So, what would an example be of,
like,
a word that you think
look, soon, moon, like, to... stuff, like words like that.
Uh huh.
I just noticed that.
Some of those words, though, like
they have to be there. I get it.
Yeah.
But I'm also just, it was just an observation I had. That's all.
Okay. What about So here's the thing we sometimes do with poems, and we even could have done it, but didn't last time, with that brilliant poem, "Roses are red, violets are blue, sugar is sweet, and so are you." What's wrong with that poem? Maybe you're so familiar with it that you don't see that there's something wrong.
No, it's like the last two. It's like roses are red, violets are, like, I don't find any rhyme in it.
Violets aren't blue?
Yeah. So the rhyme scheme, remember, is XAXA. Roses are red, doesn't rhyme with anything. Violets are blue, does rhyme. Sugar is sweet, doesn't rhyme with anything. And so are you. That's rhyming. So that's kind of okay. There are poems where alternating lines rhyme and alternating lines don't. We still think of them as rhyming poems. But yeah, say it again.
Violets aren't blue.
Yeah. Yeah, violets are purple. So roses are red, violets are blue. No, they're not. So why does the poem say the violets are blue? But they clearly do have a word for blue here. So do people know this, that in the Iliad and the Odyssey, the sea is described as wine dark, but the word blue, there's no word for blue in ancient Greek? Do people know this? You neuroscience people should know this. That is that if you look at languages all over the world, if a language has three terms for color, I think they're going to be white, black, and red. So every language which only has three color words, those are the three words that it has for color. If it's got four color words, you can predict which color words, depending on how many color words it has, which color words it will have. And blue is a word that lots of languages don't have. It's one of the rarer color words in any language. And in fact, you can go online and there's a really cool visual test that you can do, which is to pick out the square. It's like, remember the dress from a few years ago? So this is kind of similar, which is pick out, there. You'll have nine squares, and you're supposed to pick out the one that's different from the other eight. And people from modern cultures, from first world economies, will immediately see that eight of them are green and one is blue, and instantaneously. But there are other cultures that if you show them these nine squares, they'll see no difference between the green and the blue, but they will see a slight difference. What we can, if we really squint, see a slight difference in shade between two of the greens, and they'll say, yeah, that's a vivid contrast between those two squares. So that's another place where what we see is also what we're taught to see, and colors are a particular thing. So this is just a footnote for you. This is not... I think why violets are blue, because you have the term blue in that little poem.
Your Zoom turned off.
That's all right. She wasn't on it anyhow.
Okay.
But and I'm recording it on this.
Okay.
So I'll just send her that.
I guess it could be like that they interpreted like a sort of bluish color from the violets, because sometimes like violets have like a more bluish tint to them.
Uh-huh.
So maybe like they're having a specific set of violets. Like maybe they have like one growing at their house, and when they look at those violets, they're like, oh yeah, violets are blue.
I like the quotation marks. Okay, good. What if you put a question mark after blue? Roses, red, violets, or blue?
They wouldn't have the same meaning because, like, it's all the statements are supposed to be true, sort of, in the poem. Like, roses are red, violets are blue, sugar is sweet, so are you. And so, like,
yeah.
If one of them is a question, it doesn't let the last statement have as much impact or truth to it because you're still questioning it, and so your last statement can be questioned too.
Okay, so what if you had roses are red, violets are blue, line two of this poem just isn't true?
That's fun.
Okay, good. Okay, I like that. But it's certainly the case that you're supposed to have four true statements, and the first three are giving you the pattern, which is every line in this poem is a true statement, right? But what about the fact that line two is false, that violets are not blue? So you're trying to make it true. You're trying to say, well, it's true enough. But what if we overread and say it's not true? Then what's the poem mean?
Then the compliment might be a lie.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like roses are red, bears don't shit in the wood, sugar is sweet, and I'd love you if I could. I don't know. But what you could have is an alternation between true and false statements. So if you said roses are red, violets are, violets are yellow, sugar is sweet, and I love you, hello? Then it would be like, you know, so is Trump going to do the right thing? Well, is the Pope going to shit in the woods? So what you have there are two... I'm so glad I'm not recording. Oh, wait. what you have there are two statements that are made to be equivalent. Or is Trump going to run for president? Does a bear shit in the woods? Two statements. You know, it's not logical, but it's a standard way that we have of talking. Is someone asks a question and you ask a rhetorical question that has the same truth value as its answer. So if you were really to be a certain kind of English teacher, which I'm not, you would say roses are red, violets are blue, sugar is sweet, and so are you, is my way of saying that I don't love you because I love you just as much as violets are blue and they're not blue. So the unrhymed lines are true, the rhymed lines are false. Sugar is sweet and so are you, that's obviously false. So there's a much simpler answer, I think, which is violets are blue because it rhymes with you. And anyone who's tried to write rhyming poetry, but also if you read a lot of rhyming poetry, one thing you can do is figure out which word was the stretch for the poet because they had another word that they wanted to rhyme with. So do you know some of the words in English that supposedly don't rhyme? Like orange is the famous one. Know any others that don't rhyme in English? There's actually a poem which has as its title all the six words that don't rhyme in English. Okay, another one is month.
Oh.
Another one is silver. Another, I mean, they're close things. You could say river and silver if you were writing a crappy folk song. And you could do it in hip hop where it would be fine because a lot of that is assonance. But silver doesn't have a perfect rhyme.
Quiver?
What?
Quiver.
Quiver, but you need the L.
Quilver.
Quilver.
Ninth
for month?
Yeah,
so those are just the last letters. If you say ninth, you may as well say, I don't know, fourth and, I don't know, truth.
I don't get the silver one because, like, when I think of rhyme, I think of just the last syllable, but, like, the L is in the first syllable of that word. It's silver.
Okay, so would you say that running and walking rhyme? Would you say that goodness and evilness rhyme?
I don't think that, like, evilness is a commonly used
word. Okay, all right. Goodness and hopelessness.
If you're trying to come up with something for a stretch, sure.
All right, so if you're kind of trying to stretch, maybe. But the basic idea in rhyme, and this is true in all languages that use rhyme, is that what's much more important is the last stressed syllable. So you could say that an ill version of this poem, or you want me to rhyme with silver? Well, I have a really ill version of this poem, using ill there. As a term of praise, like, that's ill. Are you too young for that? You are. You don't use ill as a term of praise anymore?
Yeah, that's
it. You don't say, like, wow, that's ill.
No?
Okay, ask your older siblings if you have them.
I'm not sick, dude.
Yeah, but ill is, ill replaced sick. Yeah, it did. I know, that was part of the reason you replaced it.
It sounds pretentious.
What about that be illin? No? You just can't stand someone 10 years older than you, like me, using this terminology. I got it. Okay. So the basic idea, what a perfect rhyme looks like, let's say you want a two-syllable perfect rhyme, you would have... I don't know, tightness and brightness. Tightly, brightly, something like that. What you want is the last stressed syllable and then any unstressed syllables after the last stressed syllable should rhyme. Take a look at the Byron. This is not a great example because the rhymes are what you were calling special, but it's Don Juan, Canto the Third. By the way, it is pronounced Don Juan, not Don Juan, if you're reading Byron. He begins by saying, the poem itself begins, "I want a hero, an uncommon want, when every weakened day brings forth a new one, until after filling up the world with cant, the world discovers that he is not the true one." And then he says, "I think we'll have to go back to our old friend Don Juan." And so throughout the poem, he's giving a sort of aggressively English pronunciation, because it's funny not to say Don Juan, but to say Don Juan. So this is Don Juan, Canto the Third. "Hail, muse, etc. We left Juan sleeping, pillowed upon a fair and happy breast, and watched by eyes that never yet knew weeping, and loved by a young heart too deeply blessed to feel the poison through her spirit creeping, or know who rested there, a foe to rest, had soiled the current of her sinless years and turned her pure heart's purest blood to tears." So what's the rhyme scheme, anyone? Yeah.
A-B-A-B-A-B-C-C.
Yes. This is known as ottava rima, because it's eight lines, it rhymes, it's a particular form, and the rhyme scheme is A-B-A-B-A-B-C-C. And what that means is you get a pattern that then always comes to a break with a couplet. And all of Don Juan is written in that pattern. It's actually a really fun pattern to read poetry in. It's also a really fun pattern to write poetry in. If you start trying to write ottava rima, you'll start seeing it just fall into place. It becomes amazingly fun and easy to write. But so notice, though, the rhymes are sleeping, breast, weeping, blessed, creeping, rest. And so you have an alternation between a two-syllable rhyme, sleeping, weeping, and creeping, and a one-syllable rhyme, breast, blessed, rest. And that alternation, it's not only A, B, A, B, A, B, which is already giving you a sense of alternation, but it's 1-2, 1-2, or it's bum, bop-um, bum, bop-um, bum, bop-um in the rhymes, which gives you another kind of variation as you go from the odd-numbered lines to the even-numbered lines. And it's as though what you get is a line that ends da-da, which feels a little bit more inconclusive than a line that ends da. So the even-numbered lines end more conclusively than the odd-numbered lines. That, he doesn't do this throughout the poem. I'm just trying to give you a little bit of a sense of the feel of this stanza. "Hail, muse, etc." That's actually why I brought it in, because I want to show you the etc., but we'll get to that. "We left Juan sleeping, pillowed upon a fair and happy breast." So sleeping, pillowed upon a fair and happy breast, period. "And watch," or almost period, "and watched by eyes that never yet knew weeping, and loved by a young heart too deeply blessed to feel the poison through her spirit creeping, or know who rested there, a foe to rest." So you can feel that musically the feeling is a little bit different. So silver doesn't rhyme with quiver, because you would need a mill or a dill or a still before the ver. So you could say, some people write free verse. I prefer a kind of verse that I think to be more silver, even though they'll claim that free verse is still ver hyphen z, is still verse. So you could do it by breaking a word in half, silver with still verse, and that would work. But we almost never, ever, ever hyphenate a rhyme. It's almost never okay. There are exceptions to this rule, but they're really, really one in 10,000 lines will you find an exception. where someone will take the first syllable of a word, use that as a rhyme, put the second syllable on the next line. We're going to see an example in Elizabeth Bishop, probably next week, where she writes about no one will ever, so you simply can't afford to be an eyesore, but no one will ever see a. So she's rhyming be a with see a, but the word is be an eyesore. So she does it be a hyphen an as the first letter of the next line, finishing the word an. So it can feel like cheating, or it can feel like she's doing something like her one of her best friends, James Merrill, does, which is that A hyphen N, just to show you what it looks like, so you can see it. So can everyone see up here, almost? Can't afford to be a an eyesore, but no one will ever see, and then what you won't see is in the next line, but I'll wait for you to see the poem. So can't afford to be an eyesore, but no one will ever see a, I'll just tell you the next line, but it'll just confuse you. Dog in mascara this time of the year. So what's the James Merrill joke in that? Like looked at too long, words fail out, or phase out, or look closely at the letters? What's the part about this that you are least sure is fine?
Rhyming A with A.
Okay, so rhyming A with A, but notice the rhyme is two syllables, B A and C A. It's almost ABC, right? A, B, C. But that's not what she's thinking of, I don't think. Yeah.
You're not actually seeing the word like an.
Uh-huh.
Like it's broken off. It's not, you're not seeing it.
Yeah.
She's saying you'll never see.
Okay. And if you see this printed on the page, like, you know how sometimes you copy and paste and your software decides to hyphenate something, and it just hyphenates it just the wrong place? It like hyphenates, you want to talk about converting Bitcoin into silver, so it hyphenates there. And you see that and it's like yuck, right? Mm-hmm. So what would you call that?
An eyesore.
An eyesore. So her little joke here is be an eyesore, here's the eyesore as you're reading. So that's a little joke like James Merrill's joke.
I'm like, also thinking she isn't using the semicolon correctly.
That was me. I was just trying to do this quickly. Okay, so, but yeah, okay, that's my eyesore, so that's good. Okay, so that is, if you're trying to rhyme silver, it's kind of cheating to rhyme it with stillver, because that would be an eyesore, and we really don't want to do that. So words that don't rhyme are words like month, silver. Another famous one is purple. So roses are red, violets are purple, sugar is sweet, and this is all derp-hole. What is it?
Pupil.
But does pupil really rhyme with purple? No, you need something like slurple. Like anyone who gives it a good slurp will tell you that new Coke is not as good as classic Coke. So that's rhyming purple with slurple. But you don't really want to say that to someone if you're sending them a card about how you love them. Roses are red. Violets are purple. Sugar is sweet. as a good slurple prove if you drink a sugary drink. What do we think of that? What, you're not moved? This is not like, oh my God, such a beautiful poem. It's amazing. Okay. So, it becomes obvious why the poet decided to say violets are blue, because they wanted to rhyme with you. And it's often the case, especially if you're writing poetry, but it's often the case if you are reading poetry, that you can tell what word is there for the rhyme, what word the poet wanted, and what word the poet then had to find a rhyme for. The better the poem, the harder it is to do that. The better the poem, the more both words will seem absolutely appropriate. But in Roses Are Red, Violets Are Blue, it's clear that the blue is there because the poet is reaching for a rhyme with you. And didn't want to say something like, roses are red, carnations are red too, sugar is sweet, and so are you, because that would be even worse. So the poet just tries to kind of sneak the word blue out there. It's close enough, it's all right. Okay, so part of what you don't want to do is that. So going back to stanza one, where we're looking, here's the question. What words, yeah, we have about 8 minutes left. Is there any word in stanza one that you can feel that maybe Merrill put it in because it had an O in it and he was looking for the 18th O? Okay, wait. So soon, why?
Because, like, he puts it in the, like, not hyphen. It's, like,
dash.
The longer
version. M-dash.
Yeah, M-dash. Like, then heading up. So soon. Like, he's just, like, adding that on when he could have just said, then heading off. And it would have had basically the same meaning, other than, like, having a sense of, like, rapidness. So soon, like, he could have said that
other phrase. Okay, anyone want to defend so soon? I guess I have to. Are you sort of?
Sort of. Well,
go
I was
for it.
Say, he could have also said, like, too soon, but then that would have been another O, and
yeah.
Too soon kind of seems like could fit better than so soon.
Although, isn't it, don't you say that when people are finally leaving? Well, I gotta go, so soon? And you say, yeah, get out of here.
Yeah.
To me, it feels plangent. That is, it's not sarcastic in that way, but what the sarcasm is about is, I can't believe how short life is. I can't believe how quickly O gets from B to D.
He would say somebody died, like, oh, like, gone too soon. He
yeah.
would say so soon.
Yeah.
So.
All right. Okay. Did you have another word?
Well, I was going to say so, actually, just because so is like an adverb here. It's sort of like a supplementary word, but you also wouldn't just say soon. That wouldn't have worked at all, so.
Okay. Other possibilities? I think the word that is, one way you could tell this, by the way, is if you try to recite the poem. Actually, someone try to do this if you think you can. So don't look at it. Whoever has a decent memory, and see how much of the first stanza you can do after we've spent the amount of time we've spent on it. So someone want to volunteer? If you volunteer in a third of a second after I finish this sentence, you get an A on a quiz for this class. Too late. Sorry, that was more than a third of a second. But try anyhow.
Can you see the letters? That's it.
No. All right, do it all together. Put it down.
Not even right.
No. This is good. This is good. Put it down. Don't look at it. Nobody look at it. See what you can reconstruct together.
Look closely at
the letters.
Can you see
entering stage
right?
How O makes her way from...
Wait, don't look.
How O makes her way from being
floating.
Floating
full so soon.
Floating full so soon.
was like the fourth or fifth line, wasn't it?
Okay, I'll tell you what you got so far.
I got the first two lines.
Look closely at the letters. Can you see? Entering stage right. Then floating full. Okay, what's next? Anyone remember?
Where are we?
Okay.
Is this where D&D pops up?
Say it again?
No, that's it later.
That's like the last, I think, of that stanza.
Okay, look closely at the letters. Can you see? Entering stage right, then floating full, then then heading off.
So soon.
Go on. Okay, not bad. So everyone got the word plots, which is the word that I thought you wouldn't get. Because to me, it seems like that's the word that is a slight stretch. Why is O plotting her course rather than O takes her course from B to D? So I would have said, but I might very well be wrong, that the word plots is the one that he put in to get the 18th O. That if you were to list the O words, you know, like if you're playing Spelling Bee or something, that's as he's getting to 18, plots is, for me, O. I can say plots instead of takes her course from B to D or walks her course from B to D or something like that. But for some of you, you were having trouble with other words, so maybe it's one of those. Heading off. All right, maybe it's the word off. Or so soon. But it does feel like some of the words are slightly more natural than others, and maybe some of them are reaches in the same way that blue is a reach in roses are red, violets are blue. Okay, counted the O's in the second. There were 18 of them. Okay, rhyme scheme of the poem. We have 3 minutes.
Okay.
Rhyme scheme. Okay, start with A.
A.
Okay, let's say B, even though when a line doesn't rhyme, you should say X, but we won't follow that rule. It's just a rule you should know. So A, B.
C.
A.
Okay, second stanza.
A, B. X, X, C, C, X. No.
I think it's the same.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's technically it's A, X, B, B, A, right? Mm-hmm. Second stanza is also A, X, B, B, A. C, full, soon, moon, D. Door, fail, shines, lines, four. Okay? Everyone see that rhyme scheme? Okay. The unrhymed lines. What do they end with?
Full and fail.
Yeah. Connection between them? FL. Full fail. Not fulfill, but full fail. So it's like it is a full fail, like an epic fail. But what this is known as consonantal rhyme, when you have the same consonants but different vowels. So we go from what's full to what fails. We go from the full moon to the failure of the moon. So that obviously, do we all agree that that's there? That's not English teacher overreading, the full and the fail part? They're both marked as unrhymed words, but they're also what connect the two stanzas. Yeah. The two stanzas don't rhyme with each other except through this consonantal connection. Okay, one other thing, and we'll pick up with this on Friday. Do you see the O as a numeral? If there are 18 O's in both stanzas, so it's clearly a letter he's thinking about, the O in body, can it be zero? Do you think he wanted it to be?
No.
No, okay. So and zero is what you're saying.
What?
You're saying and zero.
M?
N.
N?
Yep. You're saying absolutely no.
So I'm asking, are you saying no?
Oh.
And zero.
Okay, think about what it would mean if the O did mean zero. If the O signified zero. Okay, see you all on Friday. Just, if you haven't read through the handout, just, this is not a heavy reading course, but do the reading several times because it's light. And don't worry if you're not understanding stuff. It's fine. Do I mean Thursday? I do. I teach Tuesday, Thursday, and Tuesday, Friday. So yes, I mean Thursday.
Okay.
See you all Thursday.
Have a nice day.
You too. Bye-bye, everyone.